Chapter 3. The forest of Nadrak was unlike the Erendish forest lying far to the south. The differences were subtle, and it took Geryon several days to put his finger on them. For one thing, the trails they followed had no sense of permanence about them. They were so infrequently traveled that they were not beaten into the loamy soil of the forest floor. In the Erendish forest, the marks of man were everywhere. But here, man was an intruder, merely passing through. Moreover, the forest in Arendia had definite boundaries, but this ocean of trees went on to the farthest edge of the continent, and it had stood so since the beginning of the world. The forest teemed with life. Tawny deer flickered among the trees, and vast shaggy bison, with curved black horns shiny as onyx, grazed in the clearings. Once a bear, grumbling and muttering irritably, lumbered across the trail in front of them. Rabbits scurried through the undergrowth, and partridges exploded into flight from underfoot with a heart-stopping thunder of wings. The ponds and streams abounded with fish, muskrat, otter, and beaver. There were also, they soon discovered, smaller forms of life. The mosquitoes seemed only slightly smaller than sparrows, and there was a nasty little brown fly that bit anything that moved. The sun rose early and set late, dappling the dark forest floor with golden light. Although it was midsummer now, it was never exactly hot, and the air was rich with that smell of urgent growth common to the lands of the north, where summer was short and winter very long. Belgrath seemed not to sleep at all once they entered the forest. Each evening, as Silk and Geryon wearily rolled themselves in their blankets, the old sorcerer threaded his way back into the shadowy trees and disappeared. Once, several hours past dusk on a night filled with starlight, Geryon awoke briefly and heard the loping touch of paws, skittering lightly across a leaf-carpeted clearing, even as he drifted back to sleep. He understood. The great silver wolf was his grandfather, and he was roaming the night, scouring the surrounding forest for any hint of pursuit or danger. The old man's nocturnal roamings were as silent as smoke, but they did not pass unnoticed. Early one morning, before the sun rose, and while the trees were still hazy and half obscured by ground fog, several shadowy shapes drifted among the dark trunks and stopped not far away. Geryon, who had just risen and was preparing to stir up the fire, froze, half bent over. As he slowly straightened, he could feel eyes on him, and his skin prickled peculiarly. Perhaps 10 feet away stood a huge, dark gray wolf. The wolf's expression was serious, and its eyes were as yellow as sunlight. There was an unspoken question in those golden eyes, and Geryon realized that he understood the question.
One wonders why you are doing that.
Doing what? Geryon asked politely, responding automatically in the language of wolves.
Going about in that peculiar form.
It's necessary to do it.
Ah.
With exquisite courtesy, the wolf did not pursue the matter further.
One is curious to know if you don't find it somewhat restricting,
he noted, however. It's not as bad as it looks, once one gets used to it. The wolf looked unconvinced. He sat down on his haunches.
One has seen the other one several times in the past few darknesses,
he said in the manner of wolves.
And one is curious to know why you and he have come into our range.
Geryon knew instinctively that his answer to that question was going to be very important.
We are going from one place to another, he replied carefully. It is not our intention to seek dens or mates in your range, or to hunt the creatures that are yours.
He could not have explained how he knew what to say.
The wolf seemed satisfied with his response.
One would be pleased if you would present our esteem to the one with fur like frost,
he said formally.
One has noted that he is worthy of great respect.
One would be pleased to give him your words, Garion responded, a bit surprised at how easily the elaborate phrasing came to him. The wolf lifted his head and sniffed at the air.
It is time for us to hunt. May you find what you seek.
May your hunt be successful, Garion returned. The wolf turned and padded back into the fog, followed by his companions.
On the whole, you handled that rather well, Garion,
Belgarath said from the deep shadows of a nearby thicket. Garion jumped, a bit startled.
I didn't know you were there.
You should have,
the old man replied, stepping out of the shadows.
How did he know,
Garion asked,
that I'm a wolf sometimes, I mean?
It shows. A wolf is very alert to that sort of thing.
Silk came out from under the tree where he had been sleeping. The little man's step was wary, but his nose twitched with curiosity.
What was all that about?
He asked.
The wolves. They wanted to know what we were doing in their territory. They were investigating to see if they were going to have to fight us.
Fight?
Garion was startled now. It is customary when a strange wolf enters the hunting range of another pack. Wolves prefer not to fight. It's a waste of energy. But they will, if the situation demands it.
What happened? Silk asked. Why did they just go away like that?
Garion convinced them that we were just passing through.
That was very clever of him.
Why don't you stir up the fire now, Garion?
Belgarath suggested.
Let's have some breakfast and move on. It is still a long way to Meloria, and we don't want to run out of good weather.
Later that same day, they rode down into a valley where a collection of log houses and tents stood beside a fair-sized stream at the edge of a meadow.
Fur traders,
Silk explained to Garion, pointing at the rough settlement.
There are places like this one on just about every major stream in this part of the forest.
The little man's pointed nose began to twitch, and his eyes grew bright.
A lot of buying and selling goes on in these little towns.
Never mind,
Belgarath told him pointedly.
Try to keep your predatory instincts under control.
I wasn't even considering anything,
Silk protested.
Really? Aren't you feeling well?
Silk loftily ignored that.
Wouldn't it be safer to go around it?
Garion asked as they rode across the broad meadow. Belgarath shook his head.
I want to know what's going on ahead of us, and the quickest way to find out is to talk to people who have been there. We'll drift in, circulate for an hour or so, and then drift on out again. Just keep your ears open. If anyone asks, we are on our way toward the North Range to look for gold.
There were differences between the hunters and trappers who roamed the streets of this settlement and the miners they had met in the last village. They were more open, for one thing, less surly and distinctly less belligerent. Garion surmised that the enforced solitude of their occupation made them appreciate companionship all the more during their infrequent visits to the fur trading centers. Although they drank probably as much as the miners, their drinking seemed to lead more often to singing and laughter than to fighting. A large tavern stood near the center of the village, and they rode slowly along a dirt street toward it.
Side door,
Belgarath said tersely as they dismounted in front of the tavern. They led their horses around the building and tied them at the porch railing. The interior of the tavern was cleaner, less crowded, and somewhat lighter than the miner's tavern had been, and it smelled of woods and of open air instead of damp, musty earth. The three of them sat at a table not far from the door and ordered cups of ale from a polite serving man. The ale was a rich, dark brown, well chilled, and surprisingly inexpensive.
The fur buyers own the place, Silk explained,
wiping foam from his upper lip.
They have discovered that a trapper is easier to bargain with if he is a little drunk, so they make the ale cheap and plentiful.
I suppose that makes sense, Garion admitted. But don't the trappers know that?
But of course they do.
Why do they drink before they do business, then?
Sulk shrugged.
They like to drink.
The two trappers, seated at the next table, were renewing an acquaintanceship that obviously stretched back a dozen years or more. Their beards were both touched with gray, but they spoke lightheartedly in the manner of much younger men.
"You have any trouble with Morindum while you were up there?"
one was asking the other. The second shook his head.
"I put pestilence markers on both ends of the valley where I set out my traps," he replied. "A Morind will go a dozen leagues out of his way to avoid a spot that's got the pestilence."
The first nodded his agreement.
"That's usually the best way. Greder always claimed that curse markers worked better, but as it turned out, he was wrong."
"I haven't seen him in the last few seasons."
"I'd be surprised if you had. The Morindim got him about 3 years ago. Buried him myself. What was left of him, anyway?"
"Didn't know that. Spent a winter with him once over on the headwaters of the Cardew. He was a mean-tempered sort of man. I'm surprised that the Morindim would cross the curse marker, though."
"As near as I could judge, some magician came along and uncursed his markers. I found a dried weasel foot hung from one of them with three stems of grass tied round each toe."
"Oh, now that's a potent spell. Must have wanted him pretty badly for a magician to take that much trouble."
"You know how he was.
He could irritate people 10 leagues away just by walking by." "Well, that's the truth."
"Not anymore, though. His skull's decorating some Morind magician's quest staff now."
Garion leaned toward his grandfather.
"What do they mean when they talk about markers?" he whispered.
"They are warnings," Belgrath replied. "Usually sticks poked into the ground, decorated with bones or feathers. The Morindim can't read, so you can't just put up a signboard for them."
A stooped old trapper, his leather clothing patched and shiny from wear, shuffled toward the center of the tavern. His lined, bearded face had a slightly apologetic expression on it. Following after him came a young Nadrak woman in a heavy red felt dress belted about the waist with a glittering chain. There was a leash about her neck, and the old trapper held the end of the tether firmly in his fist. Despite the leash, the young woman's face had a proud, disdainful look, and she stared at the men in the tavern with barely concealed contempt. When the old trapper reached the center of the room, he cleared his throat to get the attention of the crowd.
"I've got a woman I want to sell," he announced loudly.
Without changing expression, the woman spat on him.
"Now, you know, that's just going to lower your price, fella," the old man told her in a placating tone of voice.
"You are an idiot, Tashor," she retorted. "No one here can afford me. You know that. Why didn't you do what I told you to and offer me to the fur buyers?"
"Oh, the fur buyers aren't interested in women, Vela," Tashor replied in that same mild tone. "The price will be better here, believe me."
"I wouldn't believe you if you said the sun was going to rise tomorrow, you old fool."
"Well, the woman, as you can see, is quite spirited," Tashor announced rather lamely.
"Is he trying to sell his wife?"
Garion demanded, choking on his ale.
"She is not his wife," Silk corrected. "He owns her, that's all."
Garion clenched his fists and half rose, his face mottled with anger. But Belgarath's hand closed firmly about his wrist.
"Sit down," the old man ordered.
"But
I said sit down, Garion. This is none of your business."
"Unless he wants to buy the woman, of course,"
Silk suggested lightly.
"Is she healthy?"
a lean-faced trapper with a scar across one cheek called to Tashor.
"She is,"
Tashor declared.
She's got all her teeth, too. Show 'em your teeth, Vela.
They are not looking at my teeth, idiot,
she told him, looking directly at the scar-faced trapper with a sultry challenge in her black eyes.
She's an excellent cook,
Tashor continued quickly.
She knows the remedies for the rheumatism, and she can dress and tan hides. Doesn't eat too much. Breath don't smell too bad unless she eats onions. Almost never snores, except when she's drunk.
If she's such a good woman, why do you want to sell her?
The lean-faced trapper and a friend wanted to know.
I'm getting older,
Tashor replied.
And I'd like a little peace and quiet. Vela's exciting to be around, but I've had all of the excitement I need. I think I'd like to settle down someplace. Maybe raise some chickens or goats?
The old trapper's voice sounded a trifle plaintive.
Oh, this is impossible, Vela burst out. Do I have to do everything myself? Get out of the way, Tashor.
Rudely, she pushed the old trapper aside and glared at the crowd, her black eyes flashing.
All right,
she announced firmly.
Let's get down to business. Tashor wants to sell me. I'm strong and healthy. I can cook, cure hides and skins, tend to common illnesses, bargain closely when I buy supplies, and I can brew good beer.
Her eyes narrowed grimly.
I have not gone to any man's bed, and I keep my daggers sharp enough to persuade strangers not to try to force me. I can play the wood flute, and I know many old stories. I can make curse markers and pestilence markers and dream markers to frighten off the Morindum, and once I killed a bear at 30 paces with a bow.
20 paces,
Tashor corrected mildly.
It was closer to 30,
she insisted.
Can you dance?
The lean trapper with the scarred face asked. She looked directly at him.
Only if you are seriously interested in buying me.
We can talk about that after I see you dance.
Can you hold a beat?
I can.
Very well.
Her hands went to the chain about her waist, and it jingled as she unfastened it. She opened the heavy red dress, stepped out of it, and handed it to Tashor. Then she carefully untied the leash from about her neck and bound a ribbon of red silk about her head to hold back her wealth of lustrous blue-black hair. Beneath the red felt dress, she wore a filmy, rose-colored gown of Malorian silk that whispered and clung to her as she moved. The silk gown reached to mid-calf, and she wore soft leather boots on her feet. Protruding from the top of each boot was the jeweled hilt of a dagger, and a third dagger rode on the leather belt about her waist. Her gown was caught in a tight collar about her throat, but it left her arms bare to the shoulder. She wore a half-dozen narrow gold bracelets about each wrist. With a conscious grace, she bent and fastened a string of small bells to each ankle. Then she lifted her smoothly rounded arms until her hands were beside her face.
"This is the beat, Scarface,"
she told the trapper.
"Try to hold it."
And she began to clap her hands together. The beat was 3 measured claps, followed by 4 staccato ones. Vela began her dance slowly with a kind of insolent strut. Her gown whispered as she moved, its hem sighing about her lush calves. The lean trapper took up her beat, his calloused hands clapping together loudly in the sudden silence as Vela danced. Geryon began to blush. Vela's movements were subtle and fluid. The bells at her ankles and the bracelets about her wrists played a tinkling counterpoint to the trapper's beat. Her feet seemed almost to flicker in the intricate steps of her dance, and her arms wove patterns in the air. Other, even more interesting, things were going on inside the rose-colored gossamer gown. Geryon swallowed hard and discovered that he had almost stopped breathing. Vela began to whirl, and her long black hair flared out, almost perfectly matching the flare of her gown. Then she slowed and once again dropped back into that proud, sensual strut that challenged every man in the room. They cheered when she stopped, and she smiled a slow, mysterious little smile.
"You dance very well," the scar-faced trapper observed.
"Naturally, I do everything very well."
"Are you in love with anyone?" The question was bluntly put.
"No man has won my heart,"
Vella declared flatly.
"I haven't seen a man yet who was worthy of me."
"That may change," the trapper suggested. "One gold mark." It was a firm offer.
"You're not serious. 5 gold marks."
"1 and a half."
"This is just too insulting."
Vella raised both hands up in the air, and her face took on a tragic expression.
"Not a copper less than 4.
2 gold marks," the trapper offered.
"Unbelievable,"
she exclaimed, spreading both arms.
"Why don't you just cut my heart out and have done with it? I couldn't consider anything less than 3.5.
"To save time, why don't we just say 3? He said it firmly, with intention that the arrangement become permanent, he added, almost as an afterthought.
"Permanent?"
Bella's eyes widened. "I like you. Well, what do you say?"
"Stand up. Let me have a look at you."
Slowly he unwound himself from the chair in which he had lounged. His tall body was as lean as his scarred face, and there was a hard, muscled quality about him. Vella pursed her lips and looked him over.
"Not bad, is he?"
she murmured to Teshar.
"You could do worse, Vella," her owner answered encouragingly.
"I will consider your offer of 3 with intentions,"
Vella declared.
"Have you got a name?"
"Tech," the tall trapper introduced himself with a slight bow.
"Well then, Tech, don't go away. Teshar and I need to talk over your offer."
She gave him an almost shy look.
"I think I like you too," she added
in a much less challenging tone. Then she took hold of the leash that was still wrapped around Tashor's fist and led him out of the tavern, glancing back over her shoulder once or twice at the lean-faced Tech.
"That is a lot of woman," Silk murmured with a note of profound respect.
Geryon found that he was able to breathe again, though his ears still felt very hot.
"What did they mean by intention?"
he quietly asked Silk.
"Tech offered an arrangement that usually leads to marriage," Silk explained.
That baffled Geryon.
"I don't understand at all," he confessed.
"Just because someone owns her doesn't give him any special rights to her person," Silk told him. "And those daggers of hers enforce that. One does not approach a Nadrak woman unless one's tired of living. She makes that decision. The wedding, customarily, takes place after the birth of her first child."
"Why was she so interested in the price?"
"Because she gets half," Silk shrugged.
"She gets half of the money every time she's sold?"
Geryon was incredulous.
"But of course, it would hardly be fair otherwise, now would it?"
The serving man who was bringing them 3 more cups of ale had stopped now and was staring openly at Silk.
"Is something wrong, friend?"
Silk asked him mildly. The serving man lowered his eyes quickly.
"Sorry," he mumbled. "I just thought you reminded me of somebody, that's all. Now that I see you closer, I realized that I was mistaken."
He put down the cups quickly, turned, and left without picking up the coins Silk had laid on the table.
"I think we had better leave," Silk said quietly.
"What's the matter?"
"He knows who I am. And there's that reward notice that's being circulated."
"Maybe you're right," Belgarath agreed, rising to his feet.
"He's talking with those men over there,"
Geryon said, watching the serving man,
who was in urgent conversation with a group of hunters on the far side of the room, and was casting frequent looks in their direction. "We have got about a half a minute to get outside. Let's go." The three of them moved quickly toward the door.
"You there!"
someone behind them shouted.
"Wait a minute!"
"Run!"
Belgarath barked, and they bolted outside and hurled themselves into their saddles just as a half-dozen leather-garbed men burst out through the tavern door. The shout,
"Stop those men!"
went largely unheeded as they galloped off down the street. Trappers and hunters as a breed were seldom inclined to mix themselves into other men's affairs, and Geryon, Silk, and Belgarath had passed through the village and were splashing across a ford before any kind of pursuit could be organized. Silk was swearing as they entered the forest on the far side of the river, spitting out oaths like melon seeds. His profanity was colorful and wide-ranging, reflecting on the birth, parentage, and uncleanly habits of not only those pursuing them, but of those responsible for circulating the reward notice as well. Belgarath reined in sharply, raising his hand as he did. Silk and Geryon hauled their horses to a stop. Silk continued to swear.
"Do you suppose you could cut short your eloquence for a moment?" Belgarath asked him. "I am trying to listen."
Silk muttered a few more choice oaths, then clamped his teeth shut. There were confused shouts far behind them, and a certain amount of splashing.
"They're crossing the stream," Belgarath noted. "Looks as if they plan to take this business seriously. Seriously enough to chase us, at any rate."
"Won't they give up when it gets dark?"
"They are Nadrak hunters," Silk said, sounding profoundly disgusted. "They will follow us for days, just for the enjoyment of the hunt." "There's not much we can do about that now," Belgarath grunted. "Let's see if we can outrun them."
And he thumped his heels to his horse. It was mid-afternoon as they rode at a gallop through the sunlit forest. The undergrowth was scanty, and the tall, straight trunks of fir and pine rose like great columns toward the blue sky overhead. It was a good day for a ride, but not a good day for being chased. No day was good for that. They topped a rise and stopped again to listen.
"They seem to be falling behind,"
Geryon noted hopefully.
"They're just the drunk ones,"
Silk disagreed sourly.
"The ones who are serious about all of this are probably much closer by now."
"You don't shout when you're hunting. See, look back there," he pointed.
Geryon looked. There was a pale flicker back among the trees. A man on a white horse was riding in their direction, leaning far over in his saddle and looking intently at the ground as he rode.
"If he is any kind of a tracker at all, it will take us a week to shake him off," Silk said disgustedly.
Somewhere, far off among the trees to their right, a wolf howled.
"Let's keep going," Belgarath told them.
They galloped on then, plunging down the far side of the rise, threading their way among the trees. The thud of their horses' hoofs was a muffled drumming on the thick loam of the forest floor, and clots of half-decayed debris spattered out behind them as they fled.
"We are leaving a trail as wide as a house," Silk shouted to Belgarath.
"That can't be helped for now," the old man replied. "We need some more distance before we start playing games with the tracks."
Another howl drifted mournfully through the forest from the left this time. It seemed a bit closer than the first had been. They rode on for another quarter of an hour, and then they suddenly heard a great babble of confusion to the rear. Men were shouting with alarm, and horses squealed in a panic. Geryon could also hear savage growls. At Belgarath's signal, they slowed their horses to listen. The terrified squeals of horses rang sharply through the trees, punctuated by their riders' curses and frightened shouts. A chorus of howls rose from all around. The forest seemed suddenly full of wolves. The pursuit behind them disintegrated as the horses of the Nadrak reward hunters bolted with screams of sheer panic in every direction. With a certain grim satisfaction, Belgarath listened to the fading sounds behind them. Then, his tongue lolling from his mouth, a huge, dark-furred wolf trotted out of the woods about 30 yards away, stopped and dropped to his haunches. his yellow eyes gazing intently at them.
"Keep a tight grip on your reins,"
Belgrath instructed quietly, stroking the neck of his suddenly wild-eyed mount. The wolf did not say anything, but merely sat and watched. Belgrath returned that steady gaze quite calmly, then finally nodded once in acknowledgement. The wolf rose, turned, and started off into the trees. He stopped once, glanced back over his shoulder at them, and raised his muzzle to lift the deep, bell-toned howl that summoned the other members of his pack to return to their interrupted hunt. Then, with a flicker, he was gone. Only the echo of his howl remained. Chapter 4. They rode east for the next several days, gradually descending into a broad marshy valley where the undergrowth was denser and the air noticeably more humid. A brief summer shower rolled in one afternoon, accompanied by great ripping crashes of thunder, a deluge of pounding rain, and winds that howled among the trees, bending and tossing them and tearing leaves and twigs from the underbrush to whirl and fly among the dark trunks. The storm soon passed, and the sun came out again. After that, the weather continued fair, and they made good time. Geryon felt a peculiar sense of incompleteness as he rode, and he sometimes caught himself looking around for missing friends. The long journey in search of the orb had established a sort of pattern in his mind, a sense of rightness and wrongness, and this trip felt wrong. Barak was not with them, for one thing, and the big red-bearded Kerak's absence made Geryon feel oddly insecure. He also missed the hawk-faced Silent Hetar, and the armored form of Mandorallan riding always at the front, with the silver and blue pennon snapping from the tip of his lance. He was painfully lonely for Durnik the smith, and he even missed Zenedra's spiteful bickering. What had happened at Reva became less and less real to him, and all the elaborate ceremony that had attended his betrothal to the impossible little princess began to fade in his memory, like some half-forgotten dream. It was one evening, however, after the horses had been picketed and supper was over, and they had rolled themselves in their blankets to sleep, that Geryon, staring into the dying embers of their fire, came at last to face the central vacancy that had entered his life. Aunt Paul was not with them, and he missed her terribly. Since childhood he had felt that so long as Aunt Paul was nearby, nothing could really go wrong that she could not fix. Her calm, steady presence had been the one thing to which he had always clung. As clearly as if she stood before him, Geryon could see her face, her glorious eyes, and that white lock at her brow. The sudden loneliness for her was as sharp as the edge of a knife. Everything felt wrong without her. Belgarath was here, certainly, and Geryon was fairly sure that his grandfather could deal with any purely physical dangers, but there were other, less obvious perils that the old man either did not consider or chose to ignore. To whom could Geryon turn when he was afraid, for example? Being afraid was not the sort of thing that endangered life or limb, but it was still an injury of sorts, and sometimes a deeper and more serious kind of injury. Aunt Paul had always been able to banish his fears, but now she was not here. And Geryon was afraid, and he could not even admit it. He sighed and pulled his blankets more closely about him and slowly drifted into a troubled sleep. It was about noon, some days later, when they reached the east fork of the River Cordu, a broad, dirty brown flow running through a brushy valley in a generally southerly direction toward the capital at Yarnadrak. The pale green, waist-high brush extended back several hundred yards from either bank of the river and was silt-smeared by the high waters of the spring runoff. The sultry air above the brush was alive with clouds of gnats and mosquitoes. A sullen boatman ferried them across to the village standing on the far bank. As they led their horses off onto the ferry landing,
Belgrath spoke quietly.
I think we'll want to change direction here. Let's split up. I'll go pick up supplies, and the two of you go find the town tavern. See if you can get some information about passes leading up through the South Range into the lands of the Morendum. The sooner we get up there, the better. The Malorians seem to be getting the upper hand here, and they could clamp down without much warning. I don't want to have to start explaining my every move to Malorian Grolems, not to mention the fact that there's a great deal of interest in Silk's whereabouts just now.
Silk rather glumly agreed.
I'd like to get that matter straightened out, but I don't suppose that we really have the time, do we?
No, not really. The summer is very, very short up north, and the crossing to Meloria is unpleasant, even in the best of weather. When you get to the tavern, tell everybody that we want to try our luck in the gold fields of the North Range. There's bound to be somebody around who will want to show off his familiarity with trails and passes, particularly if you offer to buy him a few drinks.
I thought you said you knew the way.
I know one way, but it is 100 leagues east of here. Let's see if there's something a little closer. I will come by the tavern after I get the supplies.
The old man mounted and went off up the dirt street, leading their pack horse behind him. Silk and Geryon had little trouble finding someone in the smelly tavern willing to talk about trails and passes. Quite to the contrary, their first question sparked a general debate.
"That's the long way around, Besher,"
one tipsy gold hunter interrupted another's detailed description of a mountain pass.
"You go left at the falls of this stream. It saves you 3 days."
"I'm telling this, Varn,"
Besher retorted testily, banging his fist down on the scarred table.
"You can tell him about the way you go when I'm finished."
"It'll take you all day, just like that trail you're so fond of. They want to go look for gold, not admire the scenery."
Varn's long, stubbled jaw thrust out belligerently.
"Which way do we go when we get to the long meadow up on top?"
Silk asked quickly, trying to head off the hostilities.
"You go right,"
Besher declared, glaring at Varn. Varn thought about that as if looking for an excuse to disagree. Finally, he reluctantly nodded.
"Of course, that's the only way you can go, but once you get through the juniper grove, you turn left."
He said it in the tone of a man anticipating contradiction.
"Left," Besher objected loudly. "You're a blockhead, Varn. You go right again."
"Watch who you're calling a blockhead, you jackass."
Without any further discussion, Besher punched Varn in the mouth, and the two of them began to pummel each other, reeling about and knocking over the benches and tables.
"They're both wrong, of course,"
another miner sitting at a nearby table observed calmly, watching the fight with a clinical detachment.
"You keep going straight after you get through the juniper grove."
Several burly men, wearing loose-fitting red tunics over their polished mail shirts, had entered the tavern unnoticed during the altercation, and they stepped forward, grinning to separate Varn and Besher, as the two rolled around on the dirty floor. Geryon felt Silk stiffen beside him.
"Malorians,"
the little man said softly.
"What do we do?"
Geryon whispered, looking around for a way of escape. But before Silk could answer, a black-robed Grolem stepped through the door.
"I'd like to see men who are so eager to fight,"
the Grolem purred, with a peculiar accent.
"The army needs such men."
"Recruiters!" Varn exclaimed, breaking away from the red-garbed Malorians and dashing toward a side door. For a second, it looked as if he might escape, but as he reached the doorway, someone outside rapped him sharply across the forehead with a stout cudgel. He reeled back, suddenly rubber-legged and vacant-eyed. The Malorian who had hit him came inside, gave him a critical, appraising glance, and then judiciously clubbed him in the head again.
"Well?"
the Grolem asked, looking around with amusement.
What is it to be? Would any more of you like to run? Or would you all prefer to come along quietly?
Where are you taking us? Besher demanded, trying to pull his arm out of the grip of one of the grinning recruiters.
To Yarnadrak first,
the Grolem replied.
And then south, to the plains of Mishrak Achtul, and the encampment of his Imperial Majesty, Zakath, Emperor of all Meloria. You have just joined the army, my friends. All of Angarak rejoices in your courage and patriotism. And Torak himself is pleased with you.
As if to emphasize his words, the Grolem's hand strayed to the hilt of the sacrificial knife sheathed at his belt. The chain clinked spitefully as Geryon, fettered at the ankle, plodded along, one in a long line of disconsolate-looking conscripts, following a trail leading generally southward through the brush along the riverbank. The conscripts had all been roughly searched for weapons, all but Geryon, who for some reason had been overlooked. He was painfully aware of the huge sword strapped to his back as he walked along, but as always seemed to happen, no one else paid any attention to it. Before they had left the village, while they were all being shackled, Geryon and Silk had held a brief, urgent discussion in the minute finger movements of the Drasnian secret language.
I could pick this lock with my thumbnail, Silk had asserted with a disdainful flip of his fingers. As soon as it gets dark tonight, I'll unhook us and we'll leave. I don't really think military life would agree with me, and it's wildly inappropriate for you to be joining an Angarak army just now, all things considered.
Where's Grandfather?
Geryon had signaled.
Oh, I imagine he's about.
Geryon, however, was worried, and a whole platoon of what-ifs immediately jumped into his mind. To avoid thinking about them, he covertly studied the Malorians who guarded them. The Grolem and the bulk of his detachment had moved on, once the captives had been shackled, seeking other villages and other recruits, leaving only five of their number behind to escort this group south. Malorians were somewhat different from other Angaraks. Their eyes had the characteristic angularity, but their bodies seemed not to have the singleness of purpose which so dominated the western tribes. They were burly, but they did not have the broad-shouldered athleticism of the Murgos. They were tall, but did not have the lean whippet-like frames of the Nadraks. They were obviously strong, but they did not have the thick-waisted brute power of the Tulls. There was about them, moreover, a kind of disdainful superiority when they looked at western Angaraks. They spoke to their prisoners in short, barking commands, and when they talked to each other their dialect was so thick that it was nearly unintelligible. They wore mail shirts covered by coarse-woven red tunics. They did not ride their horses very well, Geryon noted, and their curved swords and broad round shields seemed to get in their way as they attempted to manage the reins. Geryon carefully kept his head down to hide the fact that his features, even more than Silk's, were distinctly non-Angarak. The guards, however, paid little attention to the conscripts as individuals, but seemed rather to be more interested in them as numbers. They rode continually up and down the sweating column, counting bodies and referring to a document they carried with concerned, even worried expressions. Geryon surmised that unpleasant things would happen if their numbers did not match when they reached Yarnadrak. A faint, pale flicker in the underbrush, some distance uphill from the trail, caught Geryon's eye, and he turned his head sharply in that direction. A large, silver-gray wolf was ghosting along just at the edge of the trees, his pace exactly matching theirs. Geryon quickly lowered his head again, pretending to stumble, and fell heavily against Silk.
"Grandfather's out there,"
he whispered.
"Did you only just notice him?"
Silk sounded surprised.
"I've been watching him for the last hour or more."
When the trail turned away from the river and entered the trees, Geryon felt the tension building up in him. He could not be sure what Belgarath was going to do, but he knew that the concealment offered by the forest provided the opportunity for which his grandfather had doubtless been waiting. He tried to hide his growing nervousness as he walked along behind Silk, but the slightest sound in the woods around them made him start uncontrollably. The trail dipped down into a fair-sized clearing, surrounded on all sides by tall ferns, and the Malorian guards halted the column to allow their prisoners to rest. Geryon sank gratefully to the springy turf beside Silk. The effort of walking with one leg shackled to the long chain which bound the conscripts together was considerable, and he found that he was sweating profusely.
"What is he waiting for?"
he whispered to Silk. The rat-faced little man shrugged. "It is still a few hours until dark," he replied softly. "Maybe. He wants to wait for that." Then, some distance up the trail, they heard the sound of singing. The song was ribald and badly out of tune, but the singer was quite obviously enjoying himself, and the slurring of the words as he drew closer indicated that he was more than a little drunk. The Malorians grinned at each other.
"Another patriot, perhaps," one of them smirked. "Coming to enlist. Spread out. We will gather him up as soon as he comes into the clearing."
The singing Nadrak rode into view on a large roan horse. He wore the usual dark-stained leather clothing, and a fur cap perched precariously on one side of his head. He had a scraggly black beard, and he carried a wineskin in one hand. He seemed to be swaying in his saddle as he rode, but something about his eyes showed him not to be quite so drunk as he appeared. Geryon stared at him openly as he rode into the clearing with a string of mules behind him. It was Yarblek, the Nadrak merchant they had encountered on the south caravan route in Ktol Murgos.
"Hold there,"
Yarblek greeted the Malorians in a loud voice.
"I see you've had good hunting. That's a healthy-looking bunch of recruits you got there." "The hunting just got easier,"
one of the Malorians grinned at him, pulling his horse across the trail to block Yarblek's way.
Me? Yarblek laughed uproariously. "Don't be a fool. I'm too busy to play soldier." "That's a shame," the Malorian replied. "I'm Yarblek, a merchant of Yartorak, and a friend of King Drosta himself. I am acting on a commission that he personally put into my hands. If you interfere with me in any way, Drosta will have you flayed and roasted alive as soon as you get to Yar Nadrak."
The Malorian looked a trifle less sure of himself.
"We answer only to Zakath,"
he asserted a bit defensively.
"King Drosta has no authority over us."
"You are in Garag Nadrak, friend," Yarblek pointed out to him.
"And Drosta does whatever he likes here. You might have to apologize to Zakath after it's all over, but by then the five of you will probably be peeled and cooked to a turn."
"I suppose that you can prove you are on official business,"
the Malorian guard hedged.
"But of course I can," Yarblek replied.
He scratched at his head, his face taking on an expression of foolish perplexity.
"Where did I put that parchment?"
he muttered to himself, and then he snapped his fingers.
"Oh, yes, now I remember. It's in the pack on the last mule. Here, have a drink, I'll go get it."
He tossed the wineskin to the Malorian, turned his horse, and rode back to the end of his pack string. He dismounted and began rummaging through a canvas pack.
"We better have a look at these documents before we decide,"
one of the others advised.
"King Duster's not a sort you want to cross."
"We might as well have a drink while we are waiting,"
another suggested, eyeing the wineskin.
"That's the one thing that we can agree on,"
the first replied, working loose the stopper of the leather bag. He raised the skin with both hands and lifted his chin to drink. There was a solid-sounding thud, and the feathered shaft of an arrow was quite suddenly protruding from his throat, just at the top of his red tunic. The wine gushed from the skin to pour down over his astonished face. His companions gaped at him, then reached for their weapons with cries of alarm. But it was too late. Most of them tumbled from their saddles in the sudden storm of arrows that struck them from the concealment of the ferns. One, however, wheeled his mount to flee, clutching at the shaft buried deep in his side. The horse took no more than two leaps before three arrows sank into the Malorian's back. He stiffened, then toppled over limply, his foot hanging up in his stirrup as he fell, and his frightened horse bolted, dragging him, bouncing and flopping, back down the trail.
"I can't seem to locate the document," Yarblek declared, walking back with a wicked grin on his face.
He turned the Malorian he had been speaking to over with his foot.
"You didn't really want to see it anyway, did you?"
he asked the dead man. The Malorian with the arrow in his throat stared blankly up at the sky, his mouth agape and a trickle of blood running out of his nose.
"I didn't think so,"
Yarblek laughed coarsely. He drew back his foot and kicked the dead man back over onto his face. Then he turned to smirk at Silk as his archers came out of the dark green ferns.
"You suddenly get around, Silk. I thought Taurogos had finished you back there in stinking Tolmurgos."
"He miscalculated," Silk replied casually.
"How did you manage to get yourself conscripted into the Malorian army?"
Yarblek asked curiously, all traces of his feigned drunkenness gone now. Silk shrugged.
"I got careless." "I have been following you for the last 3 days."
"I'm touched by your concern." Silk lifted his fettered ankle and jingled the chain. "Would it be too much trouble for you to unlock this?"
"You're not going to do anything foolish, are you?"
"No, of course not."
"Find the key,"
Yarblek told one of his archers.
"What you going to do with us?"
Besher asked nervously, eyeing the dead guards with a certain apprehension. Yarblek laughed.
"What you do once the chains are off is up to you,"
he answered indifferently.
"I wouldn't recommend staying in the vicinity of so many dead Malorians, though. Somebody might come along and start asking questions."
"You're just going to let us go?"
Besher demanded incredulously.
"Well, I'm certainly not going to feed you,"
Yarblek told him. The archers went down the chain, unlocking the shackles, and each Nadrak bolted into the bushes as soon as he was free.
"Well then,"
Yarblek said, rubbing his palms together.
"Now that that has been taken care of, why don't we have a drink?"
"That guard spilled all of your wine when he fell off of his horse," Silk pointed out.
"Oh, that wasn't my wine,"
Yarblek snorted.
"I stole it this morning. You should know I would not offer my own drink to somebody that I plan to kill."
"I wondered about that," Silk grinned at him. "I thought that maybe your manners had started to slip." Yarblek's coarse face took on a faintly injured expression.
"Oh, sorry," Silk apologized quickly. "I misjudged you." "No harm done,"
Yarblek shrugged.
"A lot of people misunderstand me,"
he sighed then.
"It's a burden that I have to bear."
He opened a pack on his lead mule and hefted out a small keg of ale. He set it on the ground and broached it with a practiced skill, bashing in its top with his fist.
"Let's get drunk,"
he suggested.
"Oh, we'd really like to,"
Silk declined politely. "But we have got some rather urgent business to take care of."
"You have no idea how sorry I am about that,"
Yarblek replied, fishing several cups out of the pack.
"Oh, I knew you'd understand." "Oh, I understand all right, Silk."
Yarblek bent and dipped two cups into the ale keg.
"And I am as sorry as I can be that your business is going to have to wait. Here."
He gave Silk one cup and Garion the other, and then he turned and dipped out a cup for himself. Silk looked at him with one raised eyebrow. Yarblek sprawled on the ground beside the ale keg, comfortably resting his feet on the body of one of the dead Malorians.
"You see, Silk, the whole point of all of this is that Drosta wants you very badly. He's offering a reward for you that is just too attractive to pass up. A friendship is one thing, but business is business after all. Now, why don't you and your young friend make yourselves comfortable? This is a nice, shady clearing with soft moss to lie on. We will all get drunk, and you can tell me how you managed to escape from Tar Ogas. And then you can tell me what happened to that handsome woman you had with you down in Tal Mulgos. Maybe I can make enough money from this to be able to afford to buy her. Oh, I'm not the marrying kind, but by Torak's teeth, that was a fine-looking woman. I'd almost be willing to give up my freedom for her.
I'm sure that she'd be flattered, Silk replied.
What then?
What when?
After we get drunk, what do we do then?
Oh, we'll probably get sick. That is what usually happens. After we all get well, we will run on down to Yar Nadrak. I will collect the reward for you, and you will be able to find out why King Drosta Lekton wants to get his hands onto you so badly.
He looked at Silk with an amused expression.
Oh, you might as well sit down and have a drink, my friend. You aren't going anywhere just now.
Chapter 5 Yar Nadrak was a walled city lying at the juncture of the east and west forks of the River Kordu. The forest had been cleared for a league or so in every direction from the capital by the simple expedient of setting fire to it. And the approach to the city passed through a wilderness of burned black snags and rank-growing bramble thickets. The city gates were stout and smeared with tar. Surmounting them was a stone replica of the Mask of Torak. That beautiful, inhumanly cruel face gazed down at all who entered, and Geryon suppressed a shudder as he rode under it. The houses in the Nadrak capital were all very tall and had steeply sloping roofs. The windows of the second stories all had shutters, and most of the shutters were closed. Any exposed wood on the structures had been smeared with tar to preserve it, and the splotches of the black substance made all the buildings look somehow diseased. There was a sullen, frightened air in the narrow, crooked streets of Yar Nadrak, and the inhabitants kept their eyes lowered as they hurried about their business. There appeared to be less leather involved in the clothing of the burghers of the capital than had been the case in the back country, but even here most garments were black, and only occasionally was there a splash of blue or yellow. The sole exception to this rule were the red tunics worn by the Malorian soldiers. They seemed to be everywhere, roaming at will up and down the streets and cobblestone roads, accosting citizens rudely and talking loudly to each other in their heavily accented speech. While the soldiers seemed for the most part to be merely swaggering bullies, young men who concealed their nervousness at being in a strange country with an outward show of bluster and braggadocio, the Malorian Grolems were quite another matter. Unlike the western Grolems Geryon had seen in Skol Mirgos, they rarely wore the polished steel mask, but rather assumed a set, grim expression, thin-lipped and narrow-eyed, as they went about the streets in their hooded black robes. Everyone, Malorian and Nadrak alike, gave way to them. Geryon and Silk, closely guarded and mounted on a pair of mules, followed the rangy Yarblek into the city. Yarblek and Silk had kept up their banter during the entire ride downriver, exchanging casual insults and reliving past indiscretions. Although he seemed friendly enough, Yarblek nonetheless remained watchful, and his men had guarded Silk and Geryon every step of the way. Geryon had covertly watched the forest almost continually during the three-day ride, but he had seen no sign of Belgrath, and he entered the city in a state of jumpy apprehension. Silk, however, seemed relaxed and confident as always, and his behavior and attitude grated at Geryon's nerves, for some reason. After they had clattered along a crooked street for some distance, Yarblek turned down a narrow, dirty alleyway leading toward the river. "I thought the palace was that way," Silk said to him, pointing toward the center of town.
"It is," Yarblek replied. "But we are not going to the palace. Drosta's got company there,
and he prefers to do business in private.
The alleyway soon opened out into a seedy-looking street, where the tall, narrow-looking houses had fallen somewhat into disrepair. The lanky Nadrak clamped his mouth shut as two Malorian Grolems rounded a corner just ahead and came in their direction. Yarblik's expression was openly hostile as the two approached. One of them stopped to return his gaze.
"You seem to have a problem, friend," the Grolem suggested.
"That is my business, isn't it?" Yarblik retorted.
"Indeed it is,"
the Grolem replied coolly.
"Don't let it get out of hand, though. Open disrespect for the priesthood is the sort of thing that could get you into serious trouble."
The black-robed man's look was threatening. On a sudden impulse, Garion carefully pushed out his mind toward the Grolem, probing very gently. But the thoughts he encountered showed no particular awareness, and certainly none of the aura that always seemed to emanate from the mind of a sorcerer.
"Don't do that," the voice in his mind cautioned him. "It's like ringing a bell or wearing a sign around your neck."
Garion quickly pulled back his thoughts. "I thought all of the Grolems were sorcerers," he replied silently. "These two are just ordinary men." But the other awareness was gone. The two Grolems passed, and Yarblik spat contemptuously in the street.
"Pigs," he muttered. "I am starting to dislike Malorians almost as much as Murgos."
"Oh, they seem to be taking over your country, Yarblik," Silk observed.
Yarblik grunted.
"Let one Malorian in, and before long they are underfoot everywhere."
"Why did you let them in to begin with?" Silk asked mildly.
"Silk," Yarblik said bluntly, "I know you are a spy, and I am not going to discuss politics with you, so quit fishing for information."
"I'm just passing the time of day," Silk replied innocently.
"Why don't you mind your own business?"
"But this is my business, old friend."
Yarblik stared hard at him, then suddenly laughed.
"Where are we going?" Silk asked him, looking around at the shabby street.
"This isn't the best part of town, as I recall." "You will find out," Yarblik told him.
They rode on down the river where the smell of the floating garbage and open sewers was quite nearly overpowering. Garion saw rats feeding in the gutters, and the men in the street wore shabby clothing and had that furtive look of those who have reason to avoid the police. Yarblik turned his horse abruptly and led them into another narrow, filthy alleyway.
"We will walk from here," he said, dismounting. "I want to go in the back way."
Leaving their mounts with one of his men, they went on down the alley, stepping carefully over piles of rotting garbage.
"Down there,"
Yarblik told them, pointing at a short, rickety flight of wooden stairs leading down to a narrow doorway.
"Once we get inside, keep your heads down. We do not want too many people noticing that you are not Nadrak."
They went down the creaking steps and slipped through the doorway into a dim, smoky tavern, reeking of sweat, spilled beer, and stale vomit. The fire pit in the center of the room was choked with ash, and several large logs smoldered there, giving off a great deal of smoke and very little light. Two narrow, dirty windows at the front appeared only slightly less dark than the walls around them, and a single oil lamp hung on a chain nailed to one of the rafters.
"Sit here,"
Yarblik instructed them, nudging at a bench standing against the back wall.
"I will be right back."
He went off toward the front part of the tavern. Garion looked around quickly, but saw immediately that a pair of Yarblik's men lounged unobtrusively beside the door.
"What are we going to do?"
he whispered to Silk.
"We don't have much choice but to wait and see what happens," Silk replied.
"You don't seem very worried."
"I'm not, really."
"But we've been arrested, haven't we?"
Silk shook his head.
"When you arrest someone, you put shackles on him. King Drosta wants to talk to me, that's all."
But the reward notice said...
I wouldn't pay too much attention to that, Garion. The reward notice was for the benefit of the Malorians. Whatever Drosta is up to, he does not want them finding out about it.
Yarblick threaded his way back through the crowd in the tavern and thumped himself down on the grimy bench beside them.
Drosta should be here shortly. You want something to drink while we are waiting?
Silk looked around with a faint expression of distaste.
Oh, I don't think so, he replied. The ale barrels in places like this usually have a few drowned rats floating in them, and not to mention the dead flies and roaches.
Suit yourself, Yarblick said.
Isn't this a peculiar sort of place to find a king?
Garion asked, looking around at the shabby interior of the tavern.
You have to know King Drosta to understand, Silk told him. He has some rather notorious appetites, and these riverfront dives suit him.
Yarblick laughed in agreement.
Oh, monarchs, a lusty sort of fellow. But don't ever make the mistake of thinking that he is stupid. Oh, a little crude, perhaps, but not stupid. He can come to a place like this, and no Malorian will take the trouble to follow him. He has found that it is a good way to conduct business, that he prefers not to have reported back to Zakrath.
There was a stir near the front of the tavern, and two heavy-shouldered Nadraks in black leather tunics and pointed helmets pushed their way through the door.
"Make way," one of them barked. "And everybody rise."
"Those who are able to rise."
A wave of jeers and catcalls ran through the crowd as a thin man in a yellow satin doublet and a fur-trimmed green velvet cloak entered. His eyes were bulging, and his face was deeply scarred with old pockmarks. His movements were quick and jerky, and his expression was a curious mixture of sardonic amusement and a kind of desperate, unsatisfied hunger.
"Oh, hail His Majesty, Drosta Lekton, King of the Nadraks,"
one drunken man proclaimed in a loud voice, and the others in the tavern laughed coarsely, jeering and whistling and stamping their feet.
"My faithful subjects," the pockmarked man replied with a gross smirk. "Drunks, thieves, and procurers, I bask in the warm glow of your love for me."
His contempt seemed directed almost as much at himself as at the ragged, unwashed crowd. They whistled in unison and stamped their feet derisively.
"How many tonight, Drosta?"
someone shouted.
"As many as I can," the king leered. "It is my duty to spread royal blessings wherever I go."
"Is that what you call it?"
someone else demanded raucously.
"It is as good a name as any,"
Drosta replied with a shrug.
"The royal bedchamber awaits,"
the tavern owner declaimed with a mocking bow.
"Along with the royal bedbugs, I am sure," Drosta added.
"Ale for every man, not too drunk to swill it down. Let my loyal subjects drink to my vitality."
The crowd cheered as the king pushed toward a stairway, leading to the upper stories of the building.
"My duty awaits me," he proclaimed,
pointing with a grand gesture up the stairs.
"Let all take note of how eagerly I go to embrace that stern responsibility."
He mounted the stairs to the derisive applause of the assembled riffraff.
"What now?" Silk asked.
"Oh, we will wait a bit," Yarblick replied. "It would be a little obvious if we went up immediately."
Garion shifted uncomfortably on the bench. A very faint, nervous kind of tingle had begun just behind his ears, a sort of prickling sensation that seemed to crawl over his skin. He had an unpleasant thought or two about the possibility of lice or fleas migrating from the scum in the tavern in search of fresh blood, but he dismissed that idea. The tingling did not seem to be external. At a table not far away, a shabbily dressed man, apparently far gone in his drink, had been snoring with his head buried in his arms. In the middle of a snore, he raised his face briefly and winked. It was Belgarath.
He let his face drop back onto his arms as a wave of relief swept over Geryon. The drunken crowd in the tavern grew steadily more rowdy. A short, ugly fight broke out near the fire pit, and the revelers at first cheered, then joined in, kicking at the two who rolled about on the floor.